Hello. Pissing down here. Can't even see the ocean through the windscreen. Hope you're all going well. Big shout out to Justin, who gave me a message back about the podcast and goes, fuck, that brought back some memories. And fingers crossed, I might be going on a mountain bike ride with him in Tasmania in February. If I can wangle it. And got in touch with Dina also, and Dina said that he might need some therapy having a look back at those days with the bong man. And I spoke to Jay, and his comments were, that's the only time I got arrested, God. But none of them have said, can it? No one said, ow, bloody hell, you're not putting that up there. I think they're waiting for the money to roll in. Hope they're patient. Okay, we're rolling, and we actually are rolling again. We're in New Zealand. Legend has it, Aotearoa, hope I said that right, was found by a fisherman called Kupe whilst out looking for a giant octopus that had been stealing his bait. God. Oh, you bastard, I know you're out here somewhere stealing my bait. It's so random, isn't it? In the vastness of the Pacific Ocean, Kupe had noticed long white clouds on the horizon. Venturing nearer, he discovered Aotearoa, which is the land of the long white cloud. The Polynesians were expert navigators and sailors. Their canoes were sometimes up to 100 feet long. Sails made from pandanus and coconut leaves made it possible to travel swiftly around the Pacific. Birds were often a signal of nearby land. Water currents and wind direction, the influence in power. And an expert knowledge of the star constellations helped maintain direction. Kupe, he wasn't the first bloke to discover these lands. Others had chanced upon it before him, and others would follow. But it was Kupe's people who took to the ocean in fleets of canoes and endured weeks out in the Pacific, risking death through starvation, dehydration, and drowning. Those who survived the journey were rewarded with the lush, diverse landscapes of Aotearoa, where volcanoes smoked and glaciers ran into the ocean. 700 or 800 years later, a shiny silver bullet dropped out of the sky through the long white clouds. 30,000 feet above sea level, minus 45 degrees and travelling at 500 miles an hour. Inside, people watched TV, farted and read newspapers in ignorant delight. After 4 hours in the sky, we landed at Hamilton Airport on the North Island. I grabbed my hand luggage. My legs were weary, knuckles without skin, sea ulcers on my arms. I was emaciated, close to starvation. My legs threatened to give way. As I walked down the steps onto the runway, I kissed the oil-stained asphalt. I had made it. 4 hours. In Hamilton, I stayed at the Flying Hedgehog. And on the notice board, I saw a push bike for sale for 150 New Zealand dollars. I rode toward the west coast. I was free again, bombing down big hills that I didn't have to climb back up. The sun was shining, and for autumn, it was warm. But in the afternoon, the rains came and the wind blew. Cold. Drilling rain into my skull and giving me an ice cream head. I didn't have pannier bags either, I just had a backpack, so I just tied it on the back of my bike. It wasn't exactly balanced out properly. Without Bryce, things didn't feel the same. I felt isolated and alone. Bryce and me had laughed off 1,000 hardships, broken the spell of misery with a stupid gesture or comment. But there's something about being only one that prevented random acts of insanity. I was inhibited by what was the sporadic flow of motorized onlookers. I had mental notions and conversations with myself, and in a few bizarre instances, talked to Bri as if he was here with me, labouring up the same hills, encouraging me to go on. But Bri was selling furniture in West London, and I was on my own. The heat of Asia that Bri and me had often cursed, I would have welcomed as a friend. I missed the lively flow of life, the farmers working the fields, the friendly stall owners, the animals roaming about the place, the kids racing us along the switchbacks of the mountain trails. New Zealand, in 1987, had a population of 3.8 million, spread over an area larger than Great Britain. I did see a few folks. They waved at me from their cars, leaving me a feeling of going even slower as I pedalled into the wind, and the wind blew harder. I hunched up behind a wall out of the bite and wedged up a piece of bread with peanut butter and honey. An old lady pulled over in a car and leant out the window to warn me of a mudslide that had taken out the road a mile or so up ahead. "You best turn back. It's a big hole. You could fit a house in it." She already laid out a challenge for me. I mean, this wasn't A to B. This was what it was all about, an adventure. Big or small, and craved like a drug from those strange loners creaking around the world. Running away from something, collecting memories like shiny coins. I'm sure I could get around the hole, and would have told her, but I was too tired to explain. I asked her if she knew of a good camp spot. Sorry for my Kiwi accent. There's a lady at work as well, and every time she says tender, for like a tender of a contract, she says Tinder. It sounds like she's talking about going on a dating site. I'm not even going to do it. There's a track up ahead on the right that leads down to Bridal Veil Falls. It's a beautiful spot, she said. I turned off the road and disappeared into the thick bush. The wind didn't follow. I was out of the chill and freewheeling. The undergrowth muted the wind and tree branches whipped past me as I wound amongst it. I followed the slippery clay path until the bush lost its density and I entered a clearing. Before man's intervention, I might have carried on straight over the edge of this cliff, but brightly painted railings saved me a 50-meter plunge. But then, like, before man's intervention, I wouldn't have had a bike. And there'd been no road to have a hole in. And I wouldn't have been there. I wouldn't have been able to fly in a silver bullet across the ocean. A handful of people had moved around the cliff edge and leant against the brightly painted railings, taking pictures of the spectacular sight of water falling 50 metres through the sky and sending out eddies to wear out the rocks below. I pitched my tent and sat inside stirring noodles. The flame of my stove got brighter, and the occasional tourists waddled back to their warm cars while they could still make out the track. The batteries of my torch ran out of charge. I sat in the darkness waiting to feel tired. no blue screen bullshit back then. When it got dark, when you're out, unless you had a torch and a book, you were done. Just you and your thoughts. The cold and isolation made my mind go all misty, and I was feeling sorry for myself, when two pairs of legs appeared at the entrance to my tent. The smooth, brown, slender legs belonged to Christine, the hairy, freckled ones to Vince. Wasn't hard to befriend Vince. He was an absolute comedian with a zest for adventure. A southerner from Dan in Surrey. Christine did her best to keep up with him. She was Dutch. The hills of New Zealand were a test to a flatlander. Vince and Christine were camping, same as me, and were heading south, same as me. I was wondering by what means they were travelling when I noticed their bicycles leant up against the bushes. For the next 50 days, we would live the same life. They pretty much made my journey 10 times better. Like, just having some mates. And he was an absolute larrikin. He was like a perfect... I couldn't have picked a better person to ride with other than my mates who I'd ridden with before. Like, he was just a fucking right joker bastard. In the morning, we helped each other get across the hole in the road that you could actually have fit a house in and headed south. That's the thing with the Kiwis. You've got to be careful because they tend to understate things. Like, oh, it's a bit of a climb. You get there and full melon. They're a hardy lot, I tell you. And another cool thing there was all the cars. You get these cars from your childhood, like Hillman Imps and Avengers and all these Stags and stuff from the 70s. And they're in perfect condition back then because they didn't get many shipments in. I think things have changed now. Last time I was back, it's full of European cars and, you know, Japanese cars and whatnot. But, back then in the 90s, you'd see people just flogging down the road in an old Mini, but like doing full motorway speeds and stuff. It's great. For the next 50 days, we would share the same life. In the morning, we helped each other get across this massive hole in the road and headed south. When I say hole in the road, it was like pretty much climbing down a small mountain and climbing up the other side. If you Google New Zealand and landslips, you'll be amazed. Because the land's so new, with it being so volcanic, and a lot of trees are just hanging on the edge of it. Like, some of the steepness that vegetation hangs to is it's a miracle, to be fair. Our lives were very simple. We ate, cycled, ate, slept, ate, washed in rivers, ate, sat around fires telling stories. And as a consequence of all this eating, we dug holes in the ground. It was this very act that broke the ice with Vince and Christine. Because I was guilty of forgetting the downed wind policy. And I think it was probably because the only cover was by trees upwind from our camp. So there's like, we're down on this open area and there was trees behind us set back probably 50 metres or less. And there was like a natural alleyway through these trees. You know those times when you do a poo and you look back and go, oh my God. Did that just come out of my butt? What a stench, Vince yelled out. Oh my God, what have you been eating? Contrary to the laws of nature, this actually sealed our friendship. I had fast-tracked, and now farting and all the rest was fine and dandy all around. I think I might have said this before, but if you ever spend a full day with someone, that's the test, right? Because how many people have friends and you just meet them for an hour or two and they're on the best behavior, but you hang out with someone for 24 hours a day, day in, day out, you pretty much get to know each other pretty well. Even in your dreams. There was a funny story with Dickie Hanlon. We were camping in this town in Cordoba. We'd come from Fuengirola into Cordoba. Dickie had this girlfriend, Maria. She's a beautiful young Spanish lady. And we came to her village, but she didn't have a big apartment, so we ended up sleeping on this soccer pitch in our tent. And middle of the night, I hear this, oh, Maria, and this arm comes around my shoulder. Dickie, what are you doing? We followed the west coast of North Island, New Zealand, toward a place called New Plymouth. With the exception of a broken pedal and waking one morning to find a bulldozer bearing down on us, the journey was without real incident. We found a tea shop owned by a Yorkshire woman. I recommended we go in for real Yorkshire hospitality. But it turned out she was a real tight old cow. She served measly portions and played hell with Vince for taking a sneak at a newspaper.
Someone's got to read that when you're finished with it.
I realised I might have been over-romanticising of how charitable folks were back in the north. By chance, at a petrol station, we met a farmer who had cycled from Melbourne to Cape York in Australia. He repaid some of the hospitality he had been shown and invited us to dinner. We camped on his front lawn, overlooking this beautiful bay. It stood high on the hillside above an estuary and the ocean. With the help of his kelpie and his quad bike, we rounded up some lambs for crutching and paid for dinner. Yeah, New Zealand's so full on, like, I don't know. The land's so steep and there's lots of space and people are just hardy. Like this, we rode up on this massive hill with his quad bike. I was on the back and he shouted to the kelpie and it ran about, looked like it ran a kilometre and, you know, a minute or something. It just went whoosh, down this hill and rounded up this sheep from way back. When we reached New Plymouth, we were adopted by a Christian lady. She put us up in a modest house and would have shared the last of her food with us had we not offered to cook her dinner. Mount Taranaki towered in the distance. We cycled almost from sea level until the road ended. Vince and Christine lent me some warm clothes and we climbed 2.5 kilometres through the clouds and into the sky, where snow lay thick under our feet. 200 kilometres away to the east, I could see Mount Narrahoe poking out above the cloud line. In a few weeks, I would be stood atop of Narrahoe, looking back over the clouds again to where I stood now. Turquoise shelf lakes reflecting sunlight back at me as I crouched on the icy rim of this perfect volcanic cone. Next to Narrahoe, Mount Ruapehu recently blew its top, turning day to night and sprinkling ash for miles. And in 1953, a piece of its rim fell into the crater lake and sent a raging torrent down into the valley below. It washed away a bridge, and this local guy, he got a lamp and he was running down the track trying to flag the train down to stop it reaching the bridge. And the train driver just ignored him and went straight past. And the witnesses said the train carriages looked like pieces of straw being dragged down in this huge torrent. Because the water in the crater lake just adds with all rocks and becomes like this big scouring force that just beats down the valleys, just destroys things in front of it. I think there's a name for it. I think it's Lahays. I'll find that out. But we were there recently and yeah, these places just get trashed when the crater lakes leak. There's no bullshit over there too. Like, I remember we stopped at this place and there was a sign and it said, "Do not loiter, falling rocks." And in the trees behind, there was big rocks jammed into the trees. And there was a hut there we looked at recently. And there was a hut where you could stay overnight next to Narrahoe. And a few years ago, one of the volcanic vents had blown out a massive rock and it just landed on this, showered down on this overnight hut and destroyed most of it. Lucky no one was staying overnight that night. Wild, wild place. There's First thing you notice about New Zealand after being in Australia is, you know, you're sneaking around the bush trying to make a camp and you're like, oh, snakes, oh, this, you know, spiders. Oh, watch out, watch out. But you soon realise there's nothing there on the land that can actually kill you. But the land itself is always trying to kill you. It's just moving all the time. They call it the Shaky Isles because there's so many earthquakes. It's a wild joint. It was great being with Vince and Christine because I'd never actually climbed a mountain before and I didn't have the right gear. I just still had the hand-me-down clothes. And then lent me the proper gear, like fleeces and whatnot. And it's the first snow-capped mountain I'd actually been up. Taranaki, if you look at it, it looks like Mount Fuji. It's just this perfect cone by the ocean. And it's all around it is kind of flatlands as well, so it really stands out. I think when it actually blew up, the lava reached the coast. They've still got remnants of lava flows on the coast from Taranaki. Check it out, looks amazing. But yeah, just being out at sea, about climbing through the clouds and being out at sea, other mountains poking out further down the land, it's just fantastic. If you ever get a chance to do that, do it. Taranaki's dangerous, so people die on there, so we got lucky with the weather. But yeah, you need to be prepared. And Narrahoe now, you can't climb it. It's a sacred site. And Narrahoe is what they call Mount Doom in Lord of the Rings. On the 50th night, Vince, Christine and myself lay low in a woodland just outside Christchurch, while hunters in four-wheel drives drove around its fringes, lamping rabbits and letting rip with their shotguns. Yeah, that was bad. Laid in a field camping, and these dudes were like, blasting off these guns. Like, what can you do? You just got to lie there. You can't get up and say stop shooting, because you might get shot. So, it was dangerous to lie, but too dangerous to stand up, to make ourselves known. At Christchurch, I bought a map and headed out on my own, with Christine chasing after me, shouting that I was going in the wrong direction. That was it. Like, if someone else takes charge, you can become lazy, right? I would miss my friends and had become so reliant on Christine's navigational skills. I had to get used to thinking again. A couple of 100 kilometres south of Christchurch at Temuka, Jay from Australia was picking apples. I cycled down to join him. We stayed in a tiny cabin, me, him and a guy called Dave, one of his mates from Nottingham. Jay always had a supply of weed, so on the cold nights we'd sit around the heater smoking and eating huge blocks of chocolate that he'd knocked off from the supermarket. Jay was an expert shoplifter. Sorry, Jay, I know you're not like that now, but you were in desperate times, I understand. Sometimes I wait until the shelf stackers are right next to me before I strike, he told me. I'm good, honestly. I'm the guru. I followed Jay around the supermarket a few times. I never once saw him take anything, but when we arrived back at the cabin, the goods would appear from inside his coat. It was around this little table Jay showed me his book on Polynesia. It was called Nomads of the Wind, based on a documentary I'd once watched about how the Polynesians travel from Asia and around the Pacific. I copied down a map of the place in my journal to remind me to go there sometime. The plan was to earn some money and head south with Jay and Dave on their bicycles that they were only a few thousand apples away from buying. But nothing happened. Dave stayed in bed with a bad back, and Jay decided he never wanted to pick fruit again and flew back to Australia. Yeah, I'd actually gone down purposely. My whole goal was to meet Jay and Dave, and we were going to do this mountain bike. We're going to do this ride up through New Zealand. And they both fucked off. Picking apples too was a bugger. Like, it's like picking snowballs. You're like, because they needed the frost to send them off. The red and green apples, the ladder I balanced on became a blur. When I stepped back into my apple picking form, I would be working too slow to be earning a living. In the mornings, the hollows in the apple orchards held pockets of frost. The apples were frozen. I was picking snowballs and my hands were so cold, I had to constantly sacrifice the heat from my lower regions to thaw them out. Gross when you think about eating apples. Sorry, anyone who ate an apple from New Zealand in 1997, they did wash them afterwards. I was often penalised by the orchard supervisor for snapping off shooters for next year's apples. It's a catch-22 situation. The pace dictated to earn enough money was so fast, it was impossible to take adequate care of the trees. When my stomach twisted and told me, Rich, let's get the sweet fuck out of here, the open road promised me freedom. The orchard boss told me he'd send me my final wages and I cycled away. The orchard boss sent me half the money he owed and kept the rest, hoping I was too far away to come back and kill him. You dick. What did I say about people taking advantage of fruit pickers? Fuckers. A noise woke me, more for its locality than its loudness. It was a faint scratching noise that would start but stop with my movements. I was camped in between some bushes so close to the highway that I could feel the airstream and the ground vibrations from passing trucks. I reached for the zip and behind the mask of the noisy trucks opened the door. It was early, but in the half light, I could see a mouse only inches from my face. It stopped from gnawing the charcoal off the bottom of my pan and rose up on its back legs, sniffing my scent on the breeze. That was sweet. I rode across the plains toward the snow-capped mountains in the south. The further south I travelled, the colder it got. I lay on the shores of Lake Pukaki, so clear and pure. The wind pushes up waves across the lake and caused a blizzard on the heights of Mount Cook way off in the distance. And Mount Cook is 3,700 some metres high. And it's where Sir Edmund Hillary learnt how to climb difficult sections of rock. They got the Southern Alps, which was a volcanic plate uplift geology thing. Hang on. Yeah, in South Island, New Zealand, they've got the Southern Alps, which was where two tectonic plates, I think Australian and the Kiwi one, look up for further details. And it was like a Greek wedding. The plates touched each other and shot up in the air. And then there's snow on top. And there's about 60 glaciers in New Zealand. There's a couple of famous ones that go to the ocean, but they're receding so much now. But the reason these lakes were so blue is on the glaciers. So a glacier, quick lesson, is something like 10,000 years of compacted snow. And then they're like this big ice block. As they move slowly down the valley, they grind all the rock beneath it and it creates like a flower. And this flower can't sink, so it stays suspended in the water, and that's what gives the beautiful blues you see in New Zealand. We were there recently and I just wanted to like get a bag of it, take it home and put it in my dam. Bag that flower! Makes everywhere look worth swimming. Could be like the stinkiest, most polluted water with nuclear waste in it, but chuck a bag of that flower in. Oh, look at that water. Just draws you in. In Asia, Brian myself would wake up early before the sun traced the equator and threatened to boil us in our own blood. But now I huddled around my fire, waiting for the sun's weak arc on the horizon to warm me. This was winter. A stank of smoke. My old cheap coat was burnt from reading The Adventures of Marco Polo too close to the fire. was freezing down here on South Island, and in my cheap, useless equipment, freezing. During the night, the wind had come howling down the valley, ripping up all but one of my tent pegs. I woke up with my knees under my chin and cooked right there in my sleeping bag. Porridge and honey. The heat filled my stomach. Wrapped in many layers of clothing, I rolled out the cold boulder from my sleeping bag. Last night, I'd got this big boulder from a fire. It was so friggin' cold. It was glowing red. Well, probably wasn't glowing red. Felt like it was glowing red. It was a piece of lava. I wrapped it up in my towel and put it in the bottom of my sleeping bag. Yeah, but when I woke up, this rock was freezing, so it was even colder. I called it a Stone Age hot water bottle. Aotearoa, but for the marine life, I always have to say that in a serious Māori accent. Aotearoa. I can't just go, Aotearoa. Aotearoa, but for the marine life, was starved of native mammals. During the times when fur trading was accepted, possums were brought over from Australia to be set free, and once established, they were hunted for the furs. The trappers did well, but times changed, and in the end, the Kiwis were left with millions of these destructive little buggers. There's at least 60 million of these possums in New Zealand, and it brings out the murderer in a lot of people. So weird when you got vermin mammals. Like in Australia, they are actually native, so. Like, oh, look at the little possum. Hi, you little possum. But over there, they're like, kill the bastard. Poor buggers. They didn't choose to go over there. Once again, man's intervention had fucked up the balance of nature. I was riding along the plains of the south, and the wind was howling against me. I was wondering where I could camp and where I could make a meal out of all I had left, which was peanut butter and rice. When suddenly, carrots started appearing all frosted over on the edge of the road. More carrots! More carrots! Damn, a lorry must have lost its load, I thought. I pulled over, snapped one open and took a tiny nibble from the core. Yeah, tasted okay. Although they had a strange red tinge to the skin. I put the tinge down to frost and loaded up my bag. The carrots were still by the roadside. In fact, I followed those red carrots for over 20 kilometres. Being so quick to catch on, it became obvious that these carrots weren't here by accidental fortune. They had, in fact, been painted with poison to kill off the possums. Fuck! Am I going to die? I rode until I found somebody, which in New Zealand can be a long time. I wasn't dead, and so by the time I found the guy, his answer was obvious. You're not dead? No. Well, you'd probably be okay. Lucky I bit from the core and didn't just like take a bite. I think it's strychnine or something like that. Arsenic or strychnine, and they use them to poison the possums. One of my knees was giving me jip as I rode into a headwind along the valley basin towards Wanaka, which they call Wanaka now because it sounds a lot. Mind you, it could be a Māori way to say it. I stand corrected if someone tells me that, but to me it sounds like it's the Westerners not wanting it to sound like Wanka, so they call it Wanaka. It sounds posh. Tossers. So I'm heading along toward Wanaka. Wanaka. I heard an engine, the traction of tyres, and in the corner of my eye, I saw a van approaching. I don't know if I was just getting wise, older, or soft, but I stuck out my thumb and he stopped, saving my life at that moment. And he gave me a ride 100 kilometres to just outside Wanaka. When I woke up in my roadside camp, everything was white and frosty. I needed a crap, but the ground was too hard to dig a hole. I ended up cooking inside the tent until I could actually get enough heat in my body to get outside. I put two pairs of socks on my hands and cycled into Wanaka, thinking about warm stuff. Warm shower, warm tea, warm porridge, warm purr. Warm post? Warm post from Post Restant. No, warm toast. I had a hot bath for the first time in 1.5 years with bubbles. And there was even a plastic duck that I put in just for effect. It was bloody amazing. I had a shave with a blunt razor and I was in temporary bliss. I start thinking about warm tropical Polynesia and worrying over how I could get there. But now is now, then is then, so no bother. Cup of tea, Rich. Yeah, cup of tea. That's it by Polynesia. If you look on the map, Polynesia actually includes parts of North Island, New Zealand. And I think Auckland has the highest population of Polynesians in Polynesia, just because it's a bigger landmass. I was so stoked in this backpackers. Everyone thought I was on drugs or something. I was just skipping around, and it was someone's birthday too, and I ended up getting a piece of cake. It was a joyous moment for Richie. I jumped on a bus, a ferry and a train, and headed north. The sun was up there somewhere, because this was midwinter, and I had like this cheap shit tent, my hand-me-down jacket that I had in the shearing sheds, just an old pair of work boots, and just basically everything I had was shit, and I'm riding this push bike. Yeah, it's nuts. So I ended up on this train. An Israeli couple behind me were friendly, but when I leant into the seat slightly to talk to them, the most disgusting smell of cheesy feet hit me. They smiled and joked with me, totally ignorant to the discomfort they were giving me. Because I was in front of them, and their feet were like between me and the conversation. I was trying to be polite. Slowly dying. During the train journey, they put their feet on the back of my seat. I wanted to say something, but they were so decent and friendly, I didn't want to break the mood. In front of me, a Samoan guy in his 20s was looking at me over his seat. When I looked back at him, he'd hide. It was like playing a game with a youngster. When darkness kicked in and the train windows became mirrors, he started up conversations with himself. He was really good at it too. It was like there was two people there. Poor guy obviously had something going on. And he's saying stuff like, "Hey, you're Japanese? You wear shoes to work every day?" "Ah, yes, konnichiwa." I said, "Why you wear shoes? Shoes no good." "Ah, yes, shoes no good. So why you wear every day? Like shoes no good? Fuck, I don't know." He was having these chats to himself, and he was a big dude too, a big handsome dude. And there he was with this kid's mind. But he changed from being a big, hard-looking Samoan who scared me to this young kid who I pitied. He kept moving around the train, imposing on people. "Mind if I sit here, bro?" He asked me. "Yeah, no worries. What you doing?" "Oh, I'm just writing." "Writing what?" After a while, he picked up on the feet. "Phew! What's with them feet, bro? Gotta go." The guy couldn't stay still. He flitted back and forth, teaching me a bit of Samoan, trying to get into the luggage room to get booze from his bags, and sitting with other passengers. "Please let me in. Open the fucking doors, come on, open the fucking doors, please, sorry, okay." He came back again. "You know I'm fit and strong, a good speed, no body hassle. You know I'm fit and strong, a good speed, nobody hassle me. Know why? I kill them. Touch my wand, I'll look out." Jabbed the air a few times with his fists. "I'm happy with my body. It's my dick I'm worried about." And then he loses it, laughing till tears roll down his face. "Oh shit," he says. He was at the luggage door with this stern-faced luggage lady, this train guard, with her arms folded, and he's like on his hands and knees begging, mocking, begging to get into this luggage area to get some more booze. She's shaking her head. So I was actually on North Island by now. I got off in the middle of the night. The Samoan guy put his hands against the glass trying to make me out in the night. I cycled northeast where I passed through a place called the Pukki. There was a campsite here. I was going to cycle past, but I was feeling a bit sick, so I turned round. The people here weren't tourists. They were workers, mainly islanders and Maoris. Despite being sick, I took a job with a Maori team, picking kiwi fruit. Within an hour, I was limboing under a pagoda, snapping off the furry fruit into my pouch, coughing on the fine dust and hairs that came off. A white guy who was in my picking gang took off his wraparound sunnies, which the Kiwis call speed dealers. Such a good name. They're really trendy in the 90s, but I guess if you wear them now, you're a speed dealer. I recognise this guy. He was a guy I'd worked with in that hellhole, Carnarvon in Western Australia. We were only one of a handful of Pākehās who were working here. And Pākehā means long pig in Maori. There's a thing with the Maoris when the first fleet, not the first fleets, but when Captain Cook, he went around the world 3 times apparently. And on one of his journeys, he had this goat that was the only animal that had gone around the world twice. Circumnavigated the world twice, this goat. The replica of the Endeavour came to Coffs, and I ended up being a guide on it, helping people, like showing people around. And the one thing you notice, it's really low, you bang your head a lot, and it was cluttered, like the back of where the tiller is, this massive big timber tiller that's meters long. There was loads of like farm animals, like there was a goat for milk and there was chickens for eggs. Cook, one of his claims to fame was that he fed his crew well, he gave them plenty of sauerkraut so they didn't get scurvy, and he gave them a liter of port or brandy or something like that, I think it might have been brandy, every day, so they were happy. And guys actually had like boyfriends on deck. It's like, hi, do you want to just hook up for the trip, like? And then they just like go back to their normal lives on the other end. Pretty grim. But I read this book. I think it's like a combination of all the Cook memoirs and all that. And there's this story that on the second trip, there was another crew went with him, like on another ship, and they didn't have the same discipline, and they were always wanting to get forward. And Cook's like, just take it easy, you know. If we're going to New Zealand, just don't go rushing in. You've got to do the right thing, offer some gifts, use the right protocols, or might turn bad. And these guys on the other ship apparently like, yeah, whatever, shut up, you old bastard. And they just like went forward. And a few of them went forward in this little open skiff thing. And they never came back. And they went looking for them. And they found these baskets on the beach. And one guy noticed there was like body parts wrapped up in taro leaf or something. And they'd cooked these guys. And there was like, they recognized the tattoos and stuff on their arms. Because the ultimate insult back in the day with the Maoris was to turn your enemy into poo. So to literally eat them. So yeah, that's why they became known as Pākehās, long pig, because they must have tasted similar to pig. And pig is very popular in Polynesia. It's like, it's such a great gesture if you provide a pig, like a piglet, a suckling pig at a party. Or festival, celebration. We were only a handful of Pākehās who were working here, me and this John dude from the speed dealers. along with Bob, who spoke to himself a little too often and had a bad habit of racing across and stealing fruit that was more within your grasp than his. But to be honest, most of us went a little strange under the canopy, working fast, lost in your thoughts, with only the noise being the snap, snap, snap of kiwi fruit stalks. A noise that I couldn't shake, even in my sleep, on the first few days. Yeah, so these pergola things, you kind of just limboing under them, dropping these fruit into a big oval basket you've got in your midriff. At first, time seems slow to pass until you reach the meditation stage and beyond, wandering down so many avenues of thought that by the end of the day, you have to be sucked back out into reality, staring down at your picking basket, wondering how you got there. John had been working here a while, and he was known around the camp. Two Samoans offered for him to go around to their caravan, but John declined. When they drank, they could be intimidating and rough. The last time he had called round, a Maori girl who was there asked John to strip naked and put on his picking basket. Take your clothes off and put on your picking basket. John introduced me to his friend Grant, who was in the camp kitchen slurping on some boil-up. Grant was half Parky, half Maori, in his late 30s, with a moustache. And he was a crazy rogue who suffered in the lungs from smoking too many cans. Before breakfast, he was always due a can. He said it gave him more confidence on the forklift at work and smoothed out his day. Grant's job was to stack the bins of kiwi fruit when the tractor brought them down from the fields. One day, Grant was running real smooth and cool as usual, but the young tractor driver had gotten distracted and crashed into him, sending bins and kiwi fruit everywhere. Grant couldn't get too excited about it, but when he asked the driver what happened, all the driver could say was, "Boobs. Sorry, man. Boobs." He'd been distracted somehow. The camp kitchen was only 5 metres by 5 metres, but was home to half the world. Maoris made boil-up, Indians made chapatis, Chinese boiled pig's heads and shellfish from the beach. There were Nepalese playing chess, French baking cakes, Germans, English, Sri Lankans, Cook Islanders, Tongans, Samoans, Fijians, all hanging around waiting for the rain to dry on the kiwi fruit so they could go and earn a crust. John told me there was also a Japanese guy, but he was so timid when people came to visit, he talked to them through the flap in his tent. We nicknamed him Russell, after the way he'd rustle around in his little tent. The heavy rains came and we had to take refuge in the kitchen. When they had subsided, Russell's tent was marooned in the middle of a small lake. His arm would appear from time to time as he bailed out the water, but he still didn't come out of his tent. Poor bugger. Talking about kiwi fruit as well, later on, I live with a kiwi guy in Sydney, a guy called Mike, and every time we went shopping, I go, "Oh, I'm going to get a couple of kiwis." And he'd always remind me at the end, "Fruit." Just go and get a couple of kiwi blokes or women from the shopping centre, put them in the trolley. Because the kiwi fruit was ingeniously engineered from the Chinese gooseberry. And they made it all trendy. And then there was loads and loads of millionaires in New Zealand because of this kiwi fruit. A Māori came and sat with us at the kitchen table. He had long hair and wild eyes. He was bragging about how many bins he could fill in a day. It was true, some teams were really fast. Mine and Tom's team didn't do so great because we had to carry a lazy-ass supervisor who was too hard to argue with. The big Māori guy told me that he didn't even stop for lunch.
"Eat the fruit from the trees. Don't stop, bro. Eat the fruit from the trees."
That was bad though, because they normally picked them when they weren't ripe, and the only ones you could eat were the. Here we go. I would have laughed, but he was totally serious. A ripe kiwi fruit was rare though, because they were picked early while they were still hard and packed off overseas. Other fruits grew on the orchards, the persimmons, fujias, avocados, and we would hoe into them when the orchard owner's back was turned. We found a new gang with better pay, better setup, and besides, immigration had been round a few times trying to catch illegals. They'd have a harder time finding legal workers, to be fair. One bloke from our camp had been caught. It was a really low-key bust. The guy was in his mid-40s, happily picking furry little fruit and popping them into his basket when the immigration official appeared by his side. Excuse me, do you have a work visa? It didn't sound like that. Excuse me, do you have a work visa? No. Well, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to deport you. Could you leave in a week? 2 would be better. Okay, but could you come to the car to sort things out? Sure, yes. Sorry about that. Reminded me of Michael Palin, this guy. Real mild-mannered. He could have just lied. Could have gone, oh, no, I'm not getting paid for it. I just come over to see what it was like to pick him. I just asked these guys while I took a photo. And then I got carried away. New Zealand, like most of Polynesia, is situated on a fault line. Apart from volcanoes, boiling mud pools, hot sand on the beach, and underground heating on some campsites, there were hot springs. Our new boss was all right, and he took us out one night to Mount Manganui, which is like basically a big knoll, like a mount right on the edge of the beach on the east coast of North Island. We sat in hot springs drinking beer, submerging ourselves in the heat, while a group of Maoris sang to the Polynesian strum of a guitar in beautiful voices. Thanks for listening. And there's going to be a second part to the New Zealand before I meet Little Angry Alan, the crazy cray fisherman in small speedos, white sailing boots with a great white tooth around his neck. See you in the next one. Don't forget. You just go down at the bottom of on Spotify. Go right down the bottom and it says leave a voice message. Then you just go through the motions. If you don't want to leave a voice message, you can send me a message somehow. Like leave it on my Richo Tales from the U Instagram page. That's Richo_Tales_the_ But you know what I'm saying. Basically, Richo Tales from the U with underscore between each word. And I'd appreciate that.